From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. We hear a lot of debate about solar energy, wind energy, even natural gas. But what about nuclear energy? A UNC expert says changing technology could make nuclear a key part of our energy future. Do state taxpayers and drivers spend enough money on North Carolina's roads and highways? You'll hear highlights from a recent discussion of that topic. State government might have too many chiefs and not enough Indians. That's the way one lawmaker assessed a recent report on government bureaucracy. Plus, you'll learn why the head of the state's Rules Review Commission wants to put more state regulations under the microscope. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
They're back. The General Assembly has met to officially organize for the new legislative session. The new class of lawmakers elected to office in November will gavel in for the business of policymaking later this month. They do so with a new governor, Democrat Roy Cooper, as a new element in the political equation. Joining me to look at the legislative session is Becky Gray. She is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. She spends a lot of time over at the legislature. Becky, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Governor Roy Cooper recently put out the gauntlet, so to speak. He made an announcement that he would like to expand Medicaid through Obamacare in North Carolina.
Donna, when you started the question, I thought you were going to refer to the HB2 debacle that we had in December.
Well, there's that too,
that was another one. Yeah. So this is sort of phase two that Roy Cooper has come out and really, sort of laid down the gauntlet. You know, what we're hearing, at least now, is that he intends to expand Medicaid, which is interesting because under the North Carolina Supreme or the United States Supreme Court, under North Carolina law and under the North Carolina Constitution, he can't do that.
Now, you think that was end of the story, but it's not, because it's political, as you have said.
Right. And we'll continue to. He said during his campaign that one of the things he would like to see done is to expand Medicaid. And there's certainly nothing wrong with putting that on the table, with making that a point of discussion with the General Assembly. But in a law that was passed in 2013, the General Assembly made very clear that they were the only ones that could expand Medicaid. I think that Roy Cooper's going about this in perhaps not the best way to make friends, to work together. And then, of course, what's going to happen in D.C. with the Affordable Care Act, how that impacts Medicaid. So we've got lots of moving parts here. And in order to get where we need to be, not only as a state, but as a country, we need to have cooperation and collaboration and a lot of conversation between the General Assembly, Governor Cooper, and then also to see what's going to happen out of D.C. So far, we're not seeing this, but, it's early and we'll certainly hope for that. But this is laying some groundwork for those very important relationships that are going to occur between the governor and the General Assembly. And then, of course, the courts are involved in this as well, because as we've already seen, lawsuits are flying left and right around here. So it's going to be interesting. It's also very telling how this is getting started. And so far, it doesn't look like everyone's going to be playing nicely together.
Oh, boy. It'll be fun. Now, you have created a document, you and your team at the John Locke Foundation, called The Road to Freedom.
Right.
And it pretty much lays out some of the principles and in different areas of public policy that you would like to see advanced, that the Locke Foundation would like to
Right.
see advanced during the legislative session. Do you think that there's going to be an overlap between John Locke Foundation ideas and views for how to advance freedom with legislators who are in control?
Absolutely. And there already is. There's been tremendous response to this piece. And this is something, this is not new ideas to the John Locke Foundation. Many of the things that we talk about are just continuing the momentum that we've seen over 30 years of work at the John Locke Foundation, and particularly in the last 4 or 5 years with the General Assembly and a governor that has been friendly to some of our ideas at the Lott Foundation. So, you know, in short, our recommendations is to continue along the road that we've gone with lower taxes, smarter budgeting, saving money, putting money aside for emergencies like we saw with the hurricane, the flood, the forest fires, shoring up our pension plan, making sure that teachers are paid well and that really good teachers have an opportunity to advance professionally and financially. That student-centered education is what we've certainly advocated for and would like to see that continue. Continued regulatory reform, rolling back many of the tens of thousands of rules and regulations, taking a good close look at that. So we make sure that health and safety is protected, but also that our regulations are not overly burdensome for North Carolinians, for homeowners, for business owners, for our economy. You know, Donna, the things that have been done over the last several years have really made North Carolina's economy one of the strongest in the country. And with that recovering economy, we see more jobs. We see less dependence on government services. We see businesses and entrepreneurs being able to flourish. We also see well-skilled workers being developed. All of these things that we want North Carolina and are certainly indicative of a strong and recovering economy. So that's really what we're recommending for the next General Assembly. Keep doing exactly what you've been doing. We're on the right track. We're on the road to freedom, and we just need to stay that path.
Interestingly, though, over the past several years, as those more freedom-oriented reforms were taking place in the General Assembly, you had a lot of folks on the progressive side of the policy and political spectrum who said, the sky is falling. Those are all going to be bad things for North Carolina. Do you expect that we're still going to hear that voice, particularly now that there is a Democratic governor?
Of course we are. And, you know, this is where the politics sort of trump the policy. And I think it's unfortunate. You know, we work at a think tank. We think that those ideas are important. So that's another recommendation that I've made to the General Assembly is rather than focusing on the differences and rather than finding ways to disagree, let's look at those common areas that we can look at. And there are many of them. Some of the issues that we're working on at the John Lott Foundation raise the age that has to do with juvenile justice, young people that are in prison, not those hardened criminals. But, you know, let's make sure that kids who have made a mistake pay the price for that, but also have an opportunity. Some of the other things, occupational licensing is another one that there's wide agreement on. We need to make sure that people can pursue jobs that they choose, to be able to pursue the dreams that they may have, particularly lower income professions. Let's not put up barriers for people to have to do that. There's lots of areas for agreement. There's lots of good ideas out there. And, you know, we're not the only ones with ideas, and we're certainly willing and want to talk to lots of people about different ideas and focus on those ideas, the ideas that move North Carolina forward rather than this bitter, partisan bickering that we've seen.
We know that North Carolina is one of the fastest growing states in population.
Right.
For many, many reasons people want to
It's not just the barbecue.
That's right, as you have blogged recently. And it seems like younger people, the millennial generation, a lot of them moving here because of the job opportunities and all sorts of innovative research and technological
things
areas
that we have here.
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
The North Carolina
right.
Museum of Art, for example,
yes.
A great one in Raleigh. Those folks seem very interested in the ideas that affect their opportunities, things like occupational licensing, like you mentioned, or keeping more of what they earn. It seems like those millennials would be on board with the ideas from the Lock Foundation.
And many of them are, and the more that they learn about it. You know, an area that we're doing some work on that's really interesting and has wide appeal is the impact of craft breweries. And how can we, you know, that's a growing industry in North Carolina. Lots of popularity for obvious reasons, but a real breeding ground for entrepreneurs. And, you know, that's one that we've written about a lot at the John Lott Foundation and appeals to lots of people, but particularly millennials, because they can really relate to that. And it's a product that they enjoy as well, as do many of us.
Not just the millennials.
Right, yeah.
Becky, if there was one particular issue or area of public policy that you would really like to see the legislature take a serious look at, and I know in the Road to Freedom, you have about a dozen issues that you are advancing, but what would you like them to really work on first if you had your druthers?
I think really smart budgeting and where we spend our money and how we spend it is so important. You know, we talk a lot about taxes, and that, of course, is very important. That's the revenue side of things. But where are we spending the money that we have? Are we getting the biggest bang for our buck? Are we getting quality programs? Are we making life better for North Carolinians? Are we giving them more opportunities, not taking those opportunities and freedoms away? today by the way that we choose to spend our money. Are we expanding government? Are we making people more dependent on government? Or are we opening up those opportunities so that people can provide for themselves? They can make choices in their life the way that they want to. They can truly be free.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation. Becky, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina lawmakers head back to Raleigh. There's a new governor in town. Working together or working against each other, they'll make big decisions. Decisions that affect you, your wallet, your home, your business, your kids' education. To keep up with those big decisions, day by day, even minute by minute, look to Carolina Journal, a full team of reporters and analysts. They're watching the action in the state capitol. They're reporting minute-by-minute developments for you. Carolina Journal. It's available each month as a free newspaper and every day with updated stories at carolinajournal.com. You'll find us on Facebook, too. Share items from Carolina Journal. Share items from the John Locke Foundation. Follow us on Twitter, at Carolina Journal, at John Locke NC, and at Becky Gray. Carolina Journal, it's your go-to source for news about state government and how government affects your life. Visit carolinajournal.com today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. There's lots of discussion about the future of energy in America. We hear a lot about solar power, wind power, natural gas replacing coal. But what about the future of nuclear energy? That was the topic of our next guest's recent presentation to the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Dr. David McNeilis is director of the Center for Sustainable Energy, Environment, and Economic Development at UNC's Institute for the Environment. He's also an adjunct professor of nuclear engineering at NC State. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So we really do not hear as much in the headlines these days about nuclear power, but nuclear energy is a major portion of the way that we go about dealing with energy in the U.S., isn't it?
It is. We had 104 reactors in the United States. It has been quiet because the prices of natural gas have caused concern in the nuclear industry. The revenues are not what they used to be. And so that's one driver. Another driver is there's new technology that's coming down, small modular reactors. So there's a lot of emphasis worldwide on small modular reactors. By the way, 11% of the electricity in the world on this planet is from nuclear energy. That's a lot. In the United States, it's running about 20%, North Carolina about 36%. So we get a lot of electricity from nuclear energy.
And here in North Carolina, you're just saying much more than worldwide and even the U.S.
That's correct.
Now, you mentioned that the technological changes are playing a role. Is it a good development, negative development, or hard to say at this point?
I would say tremendous. The small modular reactors are up to 300 megawatts. A large plant is 1,000 or more megawatts. So up to 300 megawatts, they can be used. They can use to provide power. They can be used to provide heat for process heat, and they can be used to desalinate or produce hydrogen, whatever one would need. In the developing world, they don't have grids that would take the big reactors like we have. 1,000 megawatts would destroy them, but these smaller reactors would work. Some of the benefits of the small modular reactors, and I'll be going into this today, but they can be built in a factory and assembled in a factory. And so where our big reactors have to be assembled online, and they have to use forgings that come from Japan, and they have to use pieces from all over the world, and they have to be done on a seismic zone, et cetera. With the small modular reactors, you build them in a factory, haul them by freight or barge to the site, and set them up on site. Now, that's one advantage. The second advantage is that they're suited, many of them are suited, to be placed underground. So you can put them down 100 feet or whatever and seal them up. And they're also designed, many of them are being designed for 10 to 30 or 40 years on recycling of fuel, so you don't have to do anything for them for that period of time. Then you would come back and replace the reactor. So that's another big point. Nonproliferation, there's no one can get at anything in the reactor. And from a fuel standpoint, many of the newer ones are going to be using a sodium or heavy metal coolant. And those will actually burn up more of the waste. They can actually use as their fuel, spent nuclear fuel. They can use uranium out of the ground, or they can use depleted uranium. So, again, the advantages are tremendous in their favor.
We are chatting with Dr. David McNeilus with UNC and NC State. It sounds also as if that in addition to the advantages being, in your words, tremendous, there's also a great deal more flexibility with these smaller reactors. If you can assemble them in a factory, more opportunities to use them. This sounds like it bodes well for the future of nuclear energy.
It does. On the other side, there's about 60 large plants under construction in the world right now, six in the United States. Four of them are new plants. Two of them are TVA plants that were started years ago and now are being completed. So there's six in construction in the United States, 60 worldwide.
We hear a lot about renewable energy and the interest in having more renewable energy. But when those discussions take place, they usually are talking about things like solar and wind power. If we're going to be serious about renewable energy, should we be focusing also on nuclear energy and its role?
Nuclear energy should be considered, particularly with new performance standards, et cetera. They should be included in that because that's part of what's driving the revenues down in the nuclear plants and causing a problem. If we're using a lot of natural gas, and that's what's picking up the slack, natural gas is half as much CO2 emissions as coal. So it's about half the same thing. And it produces some methane. Methane is 21 times as noxious in the atmosphere as is CO2.
And nuclear energy doesn't have any of those problems.
It has none of it. Once the plant is built, it doesn't have any except for the security vehicles and generators or whatever they might have running around the plant.
I have to add this because there are a lot of people out there who hear nuclear energy and still think, oh, but aren't there problems? Couldn't we have a meltdown? What about Three Mile Island? Should we be concerned about the safety of nuclear energy?
From my perspective, no. We should always be watchful. We should also be vigilant to see that everything is running okay. In the United States, those things are being well protected. At Three Mile Island, there have been no fatalities associated with Three Mile Island, and the people in the vicinity got about 1 millirem. Now, if you get a chest X-ray, it's 10 or 11 millirem, so that puts it sort of in perspective on what the damage there. Chernobyl was a different thing. Chernobyl was a consequence of bad operations, bad management, bad everything. And it was a plant, the Russian plant, the RBMK, had no containment vessel on it. Every plant in the United States and most everyone in the world has 4.5 to 5.5 feet thick of concrete around the thing. The Russians or the Soviets did not because they wanted to harvest plutonium while the reactor was running. So they wanted to get in from the top and pull rods. As of now, there are probably less than 100 people that have died as a result of Chernobyl, but over years, up to 4,000 more could have their lifetime shortened because of that incident. And that was 1986.
But as you were saying, that's a much different situation than we have
here. Very much. In
the United States and specifically North Carolina.
And to my knowledge, there have been no fatalities associated with the radiation at Fukushima.
In the brief time that we have left, given where things stand with nuclear energy and what we're hearing in the conversation about the future of energy, is the outlook good for the future of nuclear energy?
I think it's very good. And then long term, I look to fusion to come along finally, and it's going to take a couple of decades for them to get a plasma going, and then it'll take another decade or two to get actual operation. But it's a way off.
Well, one person who's going to be watching these developments very closely as they continue to happen is Dr. David McNeilus, director of the Center for Sustainable Energy, Environment, and Economic Development at UNC's Institute for the Environment, also an adjunct professor of nuclear engineering at NC State. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers have focused a lot of attention on transportation spending. Allison Primo Black represents the American Road and Transportation Builders Association. She recently put that state transportation spending in perspective.
I think Americans understand how important their transportation network is, but again, when we asked them how much they thought they paid for it, they really had no concept. The average, when you look at what citizens in this state pay for motor fuel taxes, both state and federal, as well as registration, user fees, and tolls. For people in North Carolina, it's about $39.21 a month. And, you know, that's well below what people are paying for other necessities and utilities and things that they also consider essential to what they do in their daily lives.
Does that mean North Carolina should spend more? State Representative John Faircloth of Guilford County isn't so sure.
It seems there might be a little chicken and egg situation here. If, for instance, we were to say that as a matter of policy, we're going to raise our expenditures by 30%. And the argument might be if we do that, we'll have more roads, wider roads, better transportation possibilities. Therefore, it's going to mean more travelers on the road. That's not necessarily so, because it depends on what's at each end of that road. So I'm not sure that I have a real good grasp of the relationship of that $39 to Joe taxpayer who's out here driving down the road.
The Road Building Association representative responded.
If you make transportation improvements, there could be some additional growth in travel freight on a network. It does depend where those investments are, but I would argue that if you don't make the necessary investments, you're just creating, it's almost like an inefficiency tax on businesses. And say you had an electrician who could get to 5 jobs a day, but if they had a more reliable transportation system, less congestion, maybe they could get to 6 or 7 jobs in a day. It's that type of thinking where those productivity gains come in that can really help spur growth.
Representative Phil Shepard of Onslow County put the transportation spending debate in perspective.
The problem for us is going to be to sell the consumers of North Carolina that we want to raise their taxes and their fees, because that is another situation in itself.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent legislative discussion of North Carolina transportation spending. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Does North Carolina's state government have more supervisors than it needs? A recent review from the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division suggests the answer might be yes. The report focused on spans of control and organizational layers within state agencies. Researcher Brent Lucas reminded lawmakers about a 20-year-old guideline. It calls for state agencies to have a minimum of 8 workers for every supervisor.
Of the 21 state government departments, all but one have lower supervisor-to-employee ratios, on average, than the recommended statewide minimum of 1-8. We found that the average span across departments has slightly increased since the 1990s, from 5.4 in 1995 to 6.3 this year. This means that, on average, supervisors in state departments are overseeing about 6 positions, which is still below the recommended 8. We found that supervisors in smaller departments typically oversee fewer positions than supervisors in medium or large departments.
Lucas found only limited comparison data from other states.
Texas requires agencies to have spans of 1 supervisor to 11 employees, but cannot provide a rationale for this number. Iowa has worked on spans of control and layers since the early 1990s, but their mandated span ratio of 1 to 15 has only been met by 15% of departments in the state. In Oregon, agencies are expected to meet a span ratio of 1 to 11, and departments not meeting this span ratio are prohibited from filling supervisory positions unless granted an exception.
Beyond the supervisor-to-worker ratio, Lucas also looked at state agencies' organizational layers. State guidelines call for a maximum of 7 layers between a line worker and the boss.
Of the 21 departments, 10 have more than the recommended maximum of 7 organizational layers. Organizational layers tell us the distance between frontline employees and agency leaders. And the farther this distance, the more likely there could be issues of accountability or inefficiencies. Similar to variations in spans of control across departments, There are variations in terms of their numbers of layers. More of the medium and large departments are the ones exceeding the recommended maximum of 7 layers. More than 60% of all state positions are in layers above the recommended 7th layer.
Lucas found that state agencies have a wide range of organizational layers and spans of control. These departments get little advice from either the Office of State Human Resources or the Office of State Budget and Management.
Department leaders have broad discretion in determining how they want to structure their organizations. We found that OSBM and OSHR provide only ad hoc guidance to departments on spans of control and layers. These two entities conduct a number of activities somewhat related to spans and layers, but none of these activities provide systematic guidance on spans and layers for departments. Further, we found that neither OSBM nor OSHR require departments to update and publish their high-level organization charts online. At the time of our study, only 8 departments had these high-level charts online. We also did not find requirements for departments to submit supervisory relationship changes in Beacon in a timely manner. Lastly, we found that neither OSBM nor OSHR require departments to monitor and regularly report on their spans and layers. The General Assembly should direct OSHR to monitor spans and layers for departments and direct OSBM to establish benchmarks for spans and layers and report every 5 years to the General Assembly on these subjects.
John Turcotte leads the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division. He pointed to some clear results from the new study.
There's no question that the spans are too narrow and there are too many levels. We foresee that the appropriations committees and also supported by fiscal research and OSBM can bore into this with greater depth. The fact is that the agencies have not been required to justify this. It's not even been a question, and this has just sort of evolved over time. And so we were hindered by the lack of standards, but the tool that we're providing with this report is intended to be followed up on, and we hope that it will be. But that's the, we look forward to having some interchange between departments with the fiscal research and with appropriations committee members as they go into this.
Some lawmakers found the report disturbing. Republican Senator Tom McInnes had a simple response.
It appears, in my basic layman's terms, we got too many chiefs, not enough Indians.
Republican Senator Stan Bingham latched on to one statistic that bothered him.
You say a third of all supervisors oversee 3 or fewer. That's puzzling to me, or I guess troublesome, but in your findings in the other states that you mentioned, did they have this same problem? Did you find that they had supervisors in a third of their supervisors oversaw such a small number of employees?
We were more focused on the actual span of control ratio for statewide, but we didn't see any evidence from what we were able to see of those narrow spans in other states. But it is a reduction in our own state since 1996 from 43% to 33%. So there is improvement, although it still is 33%.
Bingham hopes other states can provide North Carolina some guidance.
Since this seems to be a consistent problem, or has been, well, I don't know. I guess it's just as you've identified the problem. We didn't really realize that it was a problem. But have you heard of any other states that have run into something similar to this and made changes to or corrections to such?
Other states do require, I think it's the state of Oregon, they have the mandated ratio of, I believe it's 1 to 15, and their course of action, you might say, for achieving that span is not allowing, through the appropriations process, agencies to fill supervisory positions, unless granted an exception, until that agency meets the 1 to 15.
Well, that's certainly a good idea. That would make a huge impact on the expense to the state.
Ray Sherry of the Office of State Human Resources says a change in job classifications should help address lawmakers' concerns.
Today we have about 4,400 classifications out there. And we're reclassifying those jobs down to 1,380 classifications. Our classifications are broader. Our pay scales are going to be broader. How this will help in the level of supervision today in the old classification system, it's popular to promote somebody into the supervisor range to get them more money. Even though they're a good technical person, they all they want to do is turn wrenches all day. But to get them more money, you got to sometimes make them a supervisor. That's one way it's done. In our new classification and our new policies with our salary administration, a person can receive money for or a promotion not just from becoming a supervisor. Our policy is more job enrichment than job growth. And it focuses on if the job the person is doing, if they're gaining more technical skills, that's a reason to give them more money. If they're further away from the market compared to their other folks, that's a reason they might get more money. If there's inequity within in their department, that might be a reason to get them more money. So there's more reasons in our new classification compensation system to allow a person to receive more money than just the popular one in our old system of making them a supervisor. I believe, and most of our HR folks out there believe, that as we implement the system and we grow with the new system, that the span of control, you're going to have less people becoming supervisors, and that span of control number will be increased to a higher number.
You've been listening to discussion of a new report that suggests, as one state senator puts it, North Carolina state government agencies have too many chiefs and not enough Indians. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The head of a state commission charged with scrutinizing the thousands of rules and regulations imposed on North Carolinians by state agencies wants those agencies to be forced to take an even closer look at what's actually on the books. Garth Dunklin recently appeared before a legislative committee, and reporter Dan Way from Carolina Journal is following the story. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, when we say rules and regulations, some people's eyes kind of glaze over at that. What are we really talking about? Give us an example.
Well, these are anything that could range from environmental rules with the Department of Environmental Quality to healthcare rules involving the whole plethora of the medical field. It could be professional licensing boards. So if you are trying to get into any professional area, there are rules and regulations there that conform to how and when you can get your license, mm-hmm. or facilities management.
So it sounds as if these are all sorts of things that might impact a business, or it might impact an individual as well. Just all sorts of rules throughout state government that people don't know about until they actually get into doing some particular thing.
Both. And as the folks have found out, lots of times the agencies that impose the rules don't know what they are either. So it's part of the reason for this process.
And that's one of the interesting details that came out in your reporting on this whole review. Dan, this has been going on now for, what, a couple of years that the rules have been looked at?
Right. The Rules Review Commission went to the legislature in 2012 and asked for a process to be implemented that would sunset all rules and regulations. And initially, that was the concept. Some of the agencies said, well, that's going to be overwhelming for us to have to look at all of our rules. There are 19,302 rules in the state code, and there's another 5,000 that other agencies implement that are exempt from the process. But what ended up happening was the legislature yielded to the agencies and said, okay, we'll come up with this three-bucket system, they call it.
Explain the three buckets. What does that mean?
There are three areas in which the rules would fall under this review process. One would be to keep them in place just the way they are, the contention being that no one's really complaining about them, so there's no sense to have to go through a review process. The second bucket will be just to abolish them, eliminate them because they're no longer needed, they're outdated, or whatever. And then the third bucket would be the formal review process in which there would be a public comment, public hearing period. And the whole idea here is to get the agencies to pick up their roles, look at them periodically because, as they found out, oftentimes they would ask an agency head, what is this role for? And they would scratch their heads and say, well, gosh, that's a good question. We don't know. It's just always been there.
So. And you're not kidding about that. That's really happened.
No, that's, you know, as the Barber Examiner's Board was one in which when they looked at their roles, they just outright abolished half of them and put the other half up for review under the formal process. So in some instances, there were programs that had been out of existence for 10 years or more.
But there were still rules about them.
Rules were still on the books. So
amazing.
It makes for a very confusing process and just a lot of burdensome
extra things people would have to go through for no
exactly.
reason. So Mr. Dunklin, the gentleman who was before the legislative committee recently, the gentleman that you were reporting on, his comments, he's been overseeing this, but he's decided that this three-bucket system that you've described isn't good enough. Why not?
Well, what they found out is they proceeded through this, you know, it's a learning process for them. What they've noted was that 61% of all the roles that were being reviewed were being put in that bucket of let's keep them the way they are.
Right.
Let's not do anything. Let's just keep them there. That's less work for us. And again, that defeats the whole purpose of let's pick these up. Let's look at them. Let's see if they're still good. And if they are still good, maybe there's things that have happened over time that they need to be tweaked, updated, or just made better. Maybe you know, through the process of time and experience, I found out, well, this one doesn't really work so well. We can strengthen this, or this one is too restrictive. Let's cut back on that. So it's just a good idea to look at what you have on the books that regulate the public and businesses to make sure that it's, you know, things are best suited for the best functioning.
And he feels like he's getting a little bit of pushback on a real review, or is it just the way that the system is set up now?
Well, we'll see what happens. There could be some pushback. Some of the agencies may complain that, gosh, we had to go through the three-bucket system, and now you're making it easier for other people. time will tell on that. Some agencies have been very good about, you know, complying. Some of them have. The Industrial Commission, for example, at one point was not covered under this rules review process. The legislature said, well, okay, you have to start going through this. Mr. Dunklin said that they were excellent. They got stakeholders involved. And when they came to the Rules Review Commission, they already had things outlined, were very cooperative, very cordial, very business-like deliberations that helped them to do their roles in a real business-like fashion. So everyone was well served.
So as taxpayers, we've got to be happy about that, that there was an organization, this commission that was going along with this and saying, hey, yeah. You know, we need to take a look at these things. So that's a good news story for sure. So is Mr. Dunklin actually requesting some sort of change or help from the legislature in order to kind of hone in more, have these agencies look closer at things?
Yeah, so that's what he wants to do is eliminate that middle bucket where people can just say, we're going to keep this as is, take it off the table and move it to the side. Let's focus on these other ones. Because as he said, 61% is just too much, too many roles that are being kept intact with no review whatsoever. So that's what he's asking. So it would more closely align with what the original request was to have a sunset period for every bill rather than allowing bills to remain in place in perpetuity without ever being looked at or reexamined.
Now, you listened to this hearing, Dan. So based on the back and forth that you heard with some of those legislators who were at this hearing, did you get a sense that they were friendly to the idea of maybe eliminating that one bucket?
There's indications that some folks would be, you know, amenable to that. Some others might have more reservation. But I think that it's a good idea. It's a solid idea and one that will probably get a lot of traction. How soon this is going to come up is anybody's guess because with the change in administration, there's new department heads will be coming in. The new governor might have different ideas, so there could be a lot of things.
Yeah, that's an interesting point with the new governor, Democrat Roy Cooper. Would he play any role, or would the agencies, now that they some of them would have new people in charge, can they affect this process in any way?
They can't affect the process as it is because that's legislatively mandated. The Rules Review Commission members are appointed by the legislature, so they're safe from any governor changeover. But a governor always wants to make his stamp on government, and oftentimes they do that through the rules-making process. So a new agency head could come in and say, we don't like any of these rules, we're going to make our own. And as long as they meet with, you know, as long as they're clear, unambiguous, and meet with statutory authority, the Rules Review Commission will have to approve them. So there could be some changes.
Now, finally, Dan, you mentioned that more than 19,000 rules are subject to this whole process. Are we actually getting rid of any of these rules? Is it substantial enough that we should feel like this is really worth it?
Yeah, so of the 19,302 rules, about half of them have been looked at. 5,550 are going to be preserved as they are. 1,077 are being removed, and 2,337 are being put through the formal readoption process.
So the whole thing is working, even though Mr. Dunklin does want to see some changes. And we'll have you back to talk about this as we go forward, as they review more and more of all of these rules and regulations. Dan Way is a reporter for Carolina Journal. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.